It is 8:30, and we have with us in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How come you never introduce yourself?
It's part of my contract.
Who are you anyway?
It's with, you know, when you're in the witness protection program. They said it was weird. They said, that they hadn't actually had anybody in radio before. So, yes, I'm Mike McCormick.
That's good.
Host
good
of Mind Over Matters. So, Jav, you're back.
Yeah,
and,
I am.
I'm regretting it already.
am I regretting it or are you regretting
it? Oh, I think it's me. It's all
okay.
On my side.
Okay.
I'm sure Maria appreciates it.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad to have him back.
Yeah, you don't have to talk for a half hour.
That's
without,
right.
without cease.
So,
Well, it's good to be back in the country.
That's right. You were out of the country.
I was out of the country.
All right.
You got to experience wonderful Canadian media.
Yeah, and they let me back into the country, too. It was kind of amazing. I was surprised.
Yeah. Believe me, so am I, because I was pretty sure I had placed a call to the Homeland Security. And... anyway, we'll be having a little discussion with them later. So, speaking of out of the country, I've got several things to cover in that vein. One of them, Venezuela had a referendum that had a interesting turnout.
Yeah, fair and free elections, which was not the intent of the White House, I'm sure. This was the culmination of a years-long effort by the opposition in Venezuela to try and get rid of Hugo Chavez, backed by Washington, backed by the Pentagon, backed by the State Department. A tremendous amount of money flowed into Venezuela from the American government to the opposition, trying to analyze voter rolls, and a lot of people were concerned about the election would be stolen. But Chavez walked away with a landslide victory. It was once again a showing that he had a very large majority of the country's poor on his side. And the poor, of course, is the overwhelming majority of the voters in Venezuela. This is in the same vein that we've had anti-free trade, anti-trade liberalization, anti-Washington governments now in power in several South American countries. Through the result of popular revolt in some cases in places like Argentina and Bolivia. But one of the most interesting things about that vote was that the opposition, which is the elites who ruled Venezuela for many, many years and who are sort of used to having their own way, democracy or no, are loath to accept the results, are loath to have Chavez as president. And their claim now for disputing the election is that the election was rigged. And the way they say the election was rigged was that Venezuela is using touchscreen voting. Now, not only that, but Venezuela's touchscreen voting system has a paper trail. It has an audit trail. This was an election that was certified as fair and above board by all the international observers who were present. Nonetheless, if there's that ability by the conservative media and the former ruling elites in Venezuela to sow doubt among people willing to listen that the results of the election are in doubt because of the use of touchscreen voting machines in Venezuela, that's a precursor of what might happen with a close election in the United States in November.
Yeah, regardless of who wins, whether it's George Bush or John Kerry.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, you got to love those touchscreen terminals. And so those are...
Yeah,
are,
you got to because you don't have a choice, do you?
Yeah, unfortunately, in places like, this state where they're Secretary of State is not putting up any resistance to things like that.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Sam Reed is his name, by the way, for anybody who wants to put in a call to Olympia and complain about that.
Very good. All right. Anything else on that?
Well, just to mention that also we could tie that in with the oil price rises because Venezuela, of course, is a major exporter of oil, hence Washington's interest. They are very concerned. I don't think they care so much what Chavez does with Venezuela in particular, but his leadership of OPEC is what really frightened and alarmed them because once again, he is very critical of Washington policy and of American interests as opposed to the Saudis and some other governments that are much more favorable inclined to listen when Washington comes calling.
Well, and he also diverts oil to other countries that the U.S. Yeah. thinks he shouldn't send it to, like Cuba, for
yeah,
example.
Yeah, exactly.
The Cuban regime probably would have fallen if Venezuela hadn't stepped in and started sending them oil at discount prices, and in trade receiving from Cuba doctors that can help them staff poor clinics in rural and impoverished areas of Venezuela.
Yeah. That relationship with Cuba has been very much a sticking point with Washington. But the results of the election in Venezuela were tied in, but probably even more importantly, the standoff in Najaf with the tremendous rise in oil prices over this past, well, the past 2 months, really, but especially in the past week, we had the price rising to nearly $50 a barrel. It will probably exceed $50 a barrel at some point this week as the violence continues in Najaf. But that has tremendous implications for particularly the U.S. economy, but also the world economy as a whole. We haven't really seen at the gas pump the results at the retail level of what will happen when those prices are reflected. The rise that we've seen so far has not been tied to the rise at the wholesale level so far in the futures markets, but we will. And when that happens, and when we're paying $2.50 a gallon for gas, remember that the invasion of Iraq is largely responsible for that, and the destabilization efforts in Venezuela also contributed to it.
So you have to wonder if there's any with the Wall Streeters, if there's any office pools for when the price of a barrel is going to go over 50.
Well, if anybody has Monday as their guess, I think they'll do pretty well.
Yeah.
it's about to happen.
All right. Well, moving along, I guess that takes us to This Week in Iraq. This Week in Iraq.
Okay. I want to talk about two things in regards to Iraq this week. First of all, the main story out of Iraq was the continuous fighting in the city of Najaf. Now, it's really difficult to know what's going on there. And there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, before the U.S. Marines started their major attack on Najaf this week, they sent around some guys to the hotel where the reporters were staying, and they said, "You guys got to leave the city entirely because we can't protect you." And a few reporters
can't
left.
And won't.
Well, yeah. I think it's a combination of both. And so a few reporters left, and a lot stayed. And then after the U.S. Marines left, the Iraqi police came around on Sunday and told the reporters in the hotel, if you go outside of your hotel, you will be shot.
Yeah, they were going to set up four snipers outside the building, and we're just going to pick you
yeah,
off.
Yeah, and they were just going to shoot reporters if they went outside of the hotel to report on what was going on in Najaf. Now, I didn't hear about this anywhere in the U.S. media or the British media. I actually had to tune in to Canadian radio to hear this report. It was very interesting because they had someone on the phone, one of the reporters in the hotel, who was a reporter for Canadian media, who was telling them, no, that's what they said. The Iraqi police said that if we leave the hotel, we will be shot. So we're sitting here in our hotel rooms with binoculars trying to see what's going on, and we're sitting in our hotel rooms trying to decide if this is a story or not. Evidently, any of the U.S. reporters who remained behind in the hotel decided it wasn't much of a story.
Yeah, it was also reported in Australian media, and I believe in Europe as well, but not here.
Yeah, but not here. And another reason why it was very, very difficult for them to see what was going on was a lot of reporters left when the U.S. Marines warned them to, although those reporters did say that as they were leaving Najaf on their way back to Baghdad and Basra, that they saw hundreds of people on the road carrying banners in support of Muqtada al-Sadr, who were headed towards Najaf. And a lot of them were not fighters. They were civilians who said they were going to go to the shrine to become human shields to try to keep the U.S. troops out of the shrine in the old city of Najaf. Now, what we do know is there were reporters left embedded with the U.S. troops with the U.S. Marines who were in Najaf, and they reported a lot of devastation in the city, aerial bombing, which had wiped out the city center, and it had also wiped out several streets in the old city, a very old and historic part of the town, which
And when we're talking old, we're talking thousands of years. Yeah.
Yeah, which is built up around the shrine area. Now, this now the Imam Ali Shrine is the most sacred shrine for Shiites in the whole world. And that's the shrine where Muqtada al-Sadr's militia are sitting right now. They're not supposedly not inside the shrine, but around the shrine at this point, and they're trying to negotiate a way to get out.
It's roughly the equivalent of the Vatican. I mean,
now, in addition, a CNN reporter said that the shrine itself had taken some damage to its dome and its two minarets in the last week of fighting. Fighting has continued outside of Najaf as well, in places like Kufa, Amara, Samarra, Basra, and in Sadr City, in the Sadr City neighborhood of Baghdad. Mortars have hit the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad just yesterday. That's the U.S. Embassy. That's the former building that was the Coalition Provisional Authority's headquarters. Two pipelines were bombed, one in the north that links the Kirkuk oil fields to the main refinery at Baiji, and one in the south near Amara, which was bombed by supporters of al-Sadr. Now, this came a few days after al-Sadr supporters had set fire to an oil well in Amara, too, on Sunday. In addition, al-Sadr's supporters burned down Iraq's state oil headquarters in the city of Basra yesterday, and they said it was in revenge for the U.S. military's continuous shelling of the old city in Najaf. And I think we might see a lot more of that. Hundreds of Iraqi civilians went to become human shields in Najaf. That also means that hundreds of Iraqi civilians have been killed in the last week of fighting, but not just in Najaf, but all over the country, in places as far north as Mosul and as far south as areas just south of Basra. In addition, Polish troops have given up a part of their region of control to the U.S. troops, particularly that region around Najaf and cities nearby. It's now U.S. troops that patrol that area, and coalition troops are staying out of it. But Polish troops are also being forced to relocate their main base inside Iraq. They've been based at Babylon, but because of nightly and daily mortar attacks and other barrages, they've had to give up their base in Babylon and look for a place that's more secure. Now, meanwhile, we've learned that U.S. Marines attacked Najaf without any orders from the Pentagon or the new Iraqi government. And this comes after the Pentagon said that now the Iraqi government is in charge. We will not send troops anywhere to attack any city in Iraq without approval from the new Iraqi government. However, U.S. Marines did just that when they attacked Najaf. They did it on their own. They figured that it would be easy, that it would only take a couple days, and that they would have al-Sadr out of Najaf and captured or dead before any political firestorm would brew up. However, they didn't count on the fact that al-Sadr's supporters are highly motivated in defending what is the holiest shrine in the Shiite Muslim world.
Well, and not only that, but the civilian population that's left in Najaf is very supportive of al-Sadr as well.
Yeah, some of them aren't, particularly the businessmen who have lost their businesses to U.S. bombing, but a great portion of the Shiite population, particularly poor and middle to lower middle class people, are very supportive of Muqtada al-Sadr. As one of them said this week, he's the only religious figure in Iraq who has stood up to the occupation. Now, what happened when the Marines invaded Najaf is they said, well, we're getting bogged down here. We have to call Baghdad for reinforcements. So they called Baghdad and talked to the U.S. Army and said, please, please send us reinforcements to come and help us out. Now, it's only a 120-mile drive from Baghdad down to Najaf. It took 2 days for U.S. Army units to get there because all along the route south from Baghdad to Najaf, they were attacked continuously by guerrilla units. That gives you some idea of how bad the security situation is in Iraq right now. Now, so far, the U.S. has held back from any direct strike at the Imam Ali Shrine because I think for obvious reasons.
They understand what the result would be in terms of support within Iraq.
Yeah, they know they won't just get one oil well set on fire if they attack the Imam Ali Shrine. Now, however, the Knight Ridder News Service reported on Monday that Iraqi government forces were refusing to fight. This is after the U.S. military said, well, we'll send Iraqi forces in. They can raid the shrine, etc. Knight Ridder reported that Iraqi government forces were refusing to fight, just like in the assault on Fallujah in April. an official from the Iraqi Defense Ministry told Knight Ridder reporters that 100 Iraqi National Guard and a whole battalion of Iraqi soldiers, about 1,000 troops total, threw down their rifles and refused to attack the city. So I thought that was very, very interesting. And I think it's also a sign that it might be time to get out of Iraq.
Well, I mean, how many signs do we need? How long do we have to get that in?
Yeah, and it brings
but
up...
But that's not going to happen, though.
Yeah, it brings up an interesting question of what should the U.S. military be doing? What should the Bush administration be doing in Iraq? And I think, first of all, the very first thing is you don't attack cities. Just, you don't do that, okay? You just don't attack cities. The second thing is negotiate. Now, the U.S. government knows who the guerrilla leaders are, whether it's the Shiite leader Muqtada al-Sadr, whether it's the Sunni guerrilla leaders, particularly their Islamic representatives, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Association of Muslim Scholars. They know who to go to negotiate, and they have not done it. It's this continuous Bush administration policy that negotiating makes you a wimp. Well, I think it's pretty clear in Iraq that negotiation is what is needed. And the Bush administration, just because of, for ideological reasons, they won't do it. They have to. They really have to. That's the only way to deal with this situation.
Boys and their toys.
I mean, that's right.
It really does come down to a mindset that that we can't negotiate, that we have to go in and fight, that war is the first option rather than the last.
Yeah.
Well, diplomacy was abandoned across the board, pretty much, with this administration. You know, with tearing up the
on
treaties
all levels.
And, yeah. So.
Yeah.
Everywhere in the world. Yeah. Whether it's North Korea, Iran, Iraq, doesn't matter. They've pretty much thrown negotiations, you know, by the side of the road and left it behind.
Yeah, and that is one of the major differences between Bush and Kerry in terms of, I mean, there are certainly some areas in which there isn't as much difference as you would like, but that is one area in which Kerry has been very clear that
Kerry
he would be
has
much
not,
better.
Yeah, Kerry has not come out and said that he would negotiate with the guerrilla leaders in Iraq, but I think he's a person who could be pushed into that position,
yeah,
whereas
exactly.
I don't think George Bush would ever get there, no matter how hard you pushed him. Now, the other thing I want to talk about in Iraq is... on Sunday, the conference to select delegates for the interim council convened in Baghdad. It was a 3-day meeting of about 1,000 delegates.
And this was the meeting that was postponed from 2 weeks ago for security reasons.
Right. Well, not just security reasons, but because it was an unfair process that selected the 1,000 delegates. So what they did is in that 2 weeks is they went out and selected 300 more people to add to the 1,000 delegates. And brought them to Baghdad, and there still was some controversy because there were many people from the southern portions of Iraq who were having trouble getting there because of all of the fighting in Najaf and around those areas, who were not at the convention to do the selection process. However, now this 3-day meeting actually stretched to 4 days. The first 3 days were taken up entirely by delegates standing up and shouting, saying, look, we cannot decide on a new government for Iraq when you have the U.S. military destroying the city of Najaf. So you had one delegate after another, whether they were from southern Iraq or not, standing up and saying, we have to do something about the fighting in Najaf. Just one after the other, standing up, taking the podium and saying, we got to do something, we got to do something, we got to do something. So finally, on the second and third day, they said, okay, the organizers of the conference said, okay, we'll let you send a delegation down to al-Sadr to make a peace offering. And they did that. They flew them down in U.S. helicopters. They landed in a supposedly a neutral area, and they waited. And al-Sadr did not show up because there were U.S. helicopter gunships flying around ready to take him out if he showed up. But he did call his office in Baghdad, dictated a letter to them that was then read to the conference saying that he accepted their terms of peace. So one of the main reasons why there's not as severe fighting going on today in Najaf is because of negotiations between Muqtada al-Sadr, representatives of Ayatollah al-Sistani, and members of the interim council.
So and now al-Sistani is the leading cleric in
he's
the country.
He's the leading Shiite cleric in the country. Yes. So that's the only reason why they haven't completely wiped out the city of Najaf and raided the Imam Ali shrine is because of negotiations going on with these other delegates who decided look, if the interim Iraqi government, which was put in place by the U.S., is not going to negotiate, and the U.S. is not going to negotiate, we are. And that is what has kept the fighting down to, well, I suppose you could say, a minimum. Now, the selection of the delegate process was a total joke. That happened on day four. And it was interesting because no vote actually took place. There were very, very complicated rules set up by the group of former governing council members, most of them former exiles supported by the U.S. military and the CIA, who set up the rules for the conference. Those rules said that individual delegates could not run to be on the interim council. What they had to do is various parties had to get together and put up a slate of 81 delegates that people could vote on. And that slate of 81 delegates had to adhere to a very complicated formula that mirrored the exact ethnic, religious, tribal, etc. makeup of the country, and included 25% women on their slate. Now, there was, when it looked like one group of opposition parties were actually getting close to putting together a slate of 81 delegates, the five main exile parties, including Ahmed Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress, sent some of their lower-level guys to volunteer to be on that slate of delegates, and then when they got the 81 names together, those guys withdrew their names, making it impossible for them to put up a slate of 81 delegates. And so the group of delegates that those five parties had drawn up ahead of time, they won the vote by default. There wasn't actually a vote. They were actually just selected as the delegates by default. So it really was a farce.
It was a wonderful introduction to what we mean by installing a democratic system in Iraq.
Yeah. Yeah. So
we who are so skilled at democracy in this country.
Yeah, and it was interesting because the delegates coming out of the conference were just livid. They could not believe. They said, this is not democracy. This is a sham.
Yeah, it's interesting because we really don't give credit to Iraqis for being much more sophisticated about political processes than... I mean, the attitude from Washington very consistently has been one of paternalism.
Yeah.
That we're the only people who know how to do this, and you have to do it our way.
And it only makes things worse.
Yeah,
I
much
mean, it
worse.
It only creates much more support for the nationalist guerrillas, whether they're Sunni guerrillas or Muqtada al-Sadr's Shiite militia.
All right. Well, speaking of conventions and delegates, there's we just had a convention recently. There's another one coming up on Monday. But the FBI, seen a couple articles this week, apparently has been looking into some of the people that are going to be attending.
Yeah, it's actually starts on the 30th, the Republican convention in New York. It's coming up in a week.
Okay, I'm a week off.
You're a week off. But there's going to be hundreds of thousands of people protesting. The organizers are actually hoping for a million people at the main rally on a week from tomorrow in New York City on the 29th. But that process of organizing that rally has been fraught with difficulty. Both at the local and federal level, officials have been putting up roadblocks at pretty much every turn for the last 6 months, trying to make it difficult for organizers to protest this particular convention. And one of the things that has come out is that the FBI has been visiting protest organizers and protest leaders, and particularly some of the anarchist groups in the Midwest and in Dallas and some other parts of the country that have been organizing to come to the convention. This according to John Ashcroft, has been targeted for specific investigations on specific plots that they've uncovered. But what the ACLU, who's been contacted by some of these protest leaders and some of the leaders themselves, have been saying is that the actual interviews of protesters that have been conducted by the FBI have not mentioned any of these alleged plots at all. They've been much more fishing expeditions and according to protesters, basically intended as harassment. So this is something that went on before Boston, apparently, as well. The protests there were much smaller than the ones that are being organized for New York. But at the same time, we saw in Boston the same kind of effort to limit protests to the grossly misnamed free speech zones that are located about 3.5 miles away from from the convention center. that's not going to work in New York. There's groups that are talking about civil disobedience in New York. There's the main rally, as I said, is at minimum going to attract hundreds of thousands of people. And what we're seeing, again, from the Bush administration in support of the Republican National Convention is outright harassment of the people who would protest it. So as we get closer, we have seen in the past, particularly in 2000 in the convention in Philadelphia, the Republican convention there, preemptive arrests of a number of protest leaders. And that might be something that to look for in the next week also.
All right. And finally, moving back closer to home, I understand there was some data dug up. Was it this last week in regarding to charter schools in general? That's
yes,
kind of interesting.
Yes, the American Federation of Teachers, which in the past has been supportive of the charter school movement, went through a whole bunch of data released by the Education Department, and they found buried in that data information on how schools with charter schools with children in them were performing compared to public schools. And what they found is that children in charter schools are actually performing worse than children in public schools. Now, proponents of the charter schools said, well, this isn't fair data because it's not matching things up one-to-one. You know, kids get put into the charter school system because they're not doing well in public schools, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what the AFT did was, the American Federation of Teachers did, is they went and they said, okay, if they're poor urban children who go to charter schools, then we'll look at public schools that teach primarily poor urban children, and we will break it all down by race and ethnicity, and we will break it all down by age group. And that makes a direct one-on-one comparison. And what they found was, even after doing that, that still the students in charter schools did not do as well as the students in public schools. It's a real blow to those folks who claim that charter schools will make a difference. And it really, really adds to the charter school opponents' argument, why should we funnel scarce public education dollars into a system that's going to do worse than the public school system?
All right. Well, and finally, there is an event that's been happening for weeks now, that's months, actually.
Over a year, yeah.
A year, okay.
The Green Lake Vigil for Peace has been going on pretty much since the run-up to the original invasion a year and a half ago. Happens every Sunday afternoon. But they're making a particular effort for folks to turn out tomorrow, because in recent weeks it has been targeted by a group called Protest Warriors that is organized by right-wing radio stations like KVI. But this is national, not just local. It's happening in other cities as well, where the people who have been vigiling at Green Lake for an end to the war in Iraq have been outnumbered in recent week by what is essentially a self-styled, you know, paramilitary outfit that's showing up for operations to confront peace protesters. The protesters, the anti-war protesters themselves, have been committed to peaceful, nonviolent protests. They're doing the same thing they've always been doing, just sitting there, not looking for confrontation, but just trying to get their message out. So they're encouraging people to come. It'll be tomorrow at 2:00. The vigil is at 63rd and Green Lake Way. That's right by Green Lake, so it's a nice way to spend a Sunday afternoon. Hang out for a couple hours, vigil, wave
bring
passing
your dog,
cards.
Bring your frisbee.
Yeah, exactly. And
bring
and,
an umbrella because it might rain tomorrow.
Exactly. And make sure that people are not outnumbered by proponents of war.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every other week. It can be found at places where you find free newspapers, publications, at bookstores and cafes and whatnot. You can also find it on the web, www.eatthestate.org. If you want to volunteer, which is largely how the paper is put out, or you have story tips or comments or feedback to what you hear on the program here, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.